At Giant Eagle, you may have spotted the Stacker. With uncanny MyPerks ability, she stacks up the perks to choose either dollars off or up to 20% off her entire grocery bill. The Stacker, stacking up huge savings with MyPerks. Find your MyPerksonality and transform your shopping into free gas and groceries. Full details at GiantEagle.com/MyPerks. Perks cannot be earned or redeemed on select items. Restrictions apply.
Idea Pro Studios.
Hi, I'm Samiran.
Hi, I'm Nilesh.
Hi, I'm Sheetal. And you're listening to 3TB.
Three Techies Banter.
Hi, I'm Sheetal. Welcome to 3TB, a podcast where three techies banter. It's a podcast where you can explore tech the non-tech way. It is about how tech and the economics behind the tech impact us today and in the future. We try and make it as full of information and fun facts, and we try to speak in a language which actually everyone can understand. Today's topic is really a fun topic, and it's, you know, the beginning of 2023, and we thought that we would talk about four trends that we think are going to be very interesting to follow. The four trends that we're going to talk about today, one is the trends of the super apps. And we've actually spoken a bit about this in our previous episode where Nilesh talks about how Elon Musk is actually looking at creating a super app called X. And all of us can guess why it's called X. So there's the first trend that we're going to talk about is the trend of super apps. The second one is a trend that we think is all about the economics behind technology. And that really is business models come a full circle. Of course, this trend has been called various things in media. It is things like new business models, new ways of working, et cetera, et cetera. We just think it's a trend which is business models come a full circle. The third trend we're going to talk about, which I think Samiran is extremely happy having a point of view on, is called immortality powered by tech. And the last one, which is something that we are really interested in, are invested in, and we believe is the future of technology, as part of the whole sustainable tech piece, we're going to cover virtual power plants. I'm going to hand over to Nilesh to kind of talk us through the first trend, which is the trend of super apps.
Super app is a trend that has been, listed by a few trends that we actually followed. We thought it was an interesting bit to talk about for multiple reasons. So let me first start with whether super app is a trend to watch out for. Answer is yes, honestly. I will give my personal contrarian view on it, but super app is a trend primarily because it makes economic sense. I mean, when any organization, whether it's your, Google of the world, Facebook's, you want the consumer in your network and you don't want to let the person go out. So what do? You create a super app whereby if you had bought some couple of companies, you actually ensure that the person just remains within that network, whether it is right from, if I take a shopping experience, it's basically discovery, retail, payment, rewards. So, the whole life cycle should remain within your network and recommendations, honestly, right? So it's the whole circle of retail. So super apps is a trend to watch out for. Many people are talking about it. Elon Musk has, like Sheetal mentioned in the introduction, Elon Musk mentioned something like a super app called X. So it is happening closer to home. I mean, it has been some time back, but, Tata launched something called Tata Neu and, kind of weaved all their properties into a single app. Time will tell whether how well it does or not. But the fact is, this is something most of the companies are talking about and trying to achieve. Now, the contrarian view that I have on this is that, for me, somehow super app does not make a lot of sense. The reason being that each company and each segment of, let's say, retail journey has its own user experience, and there are companies which understand it better than the others, right? So let me take a simple example. Google used to have a chat capability for a very, very long time. It has been called various different things. It was available just within your, you know, the mailing window, but it never took off, right? While WhatsApp was sold for $19 billion to Facebook. It has always been there, but never took off. So Google could never figure out what to do with it, right? So there have been companies who are good at certain things and then somehow they don't get some other things right. They do go ahead and buy such companies. So Google bought YouTube, but YouTube has been YouTube, right? So do you really want to really tie everything into a one single super app? Maybe, maybe not. My view is it has not been successful thus far, but this is a trend people are talking about, super apps and how businesses would like to, you know, capture the imagination of their consumers.
So Nilesh, I thought, you know, one of the things I kind of thought is the difference is that, you know, if you think about super apps versus platforms, so in that, you know, Amazon was always built as a platform and whatever, Tencent and all have you. And then they keep on adding new things and, you know, obviously they keep the customer together. Super apps, like you rightly said, almost seems to be like an afterthought, which means, you know, you have a whole bunch of disparate things. Now you suddenly figured that, you know, I want to stitch it together and make it whole. And anything that you kind of put together is going to be difficult to do. So while I completely buy into the logic of keeping, locking in the customer and taking them from, you know, payments to loans to this, and then maybe to buy your groceries or whatever. But if they were never together, I mean, I don't know how that thing works homogeneously unless it was built ground up to do that. And like you mentioned, I'm sure Tata Neu will kind of fix all of this in somewhere in the future. But today it is kind of quite traumatic to try and do anything on it. So, you know, because they're bringing together apps that never worked together before. So while the logic appeals, I'm not sure whether it was, you know, how they're going to hang it all together.
My only point of view on the whole super apps is that I don't think that, and the reason why I think super apps have a long way to go is simply because when a particular app was launched, it was addressing a key problem of the consumer, right? So when Uber happens, it happens because it is solving a problem of the consumer. And therefore, it has a role in the life of the consumer to play. A super app, which is now a house of apps, if I may call it like a house of brands, becomes challenging because what is the role of the super app in the life of the consumer? Every app has a role, but does the house of apps have a role in my life to play? Maybe not. And I think of this, and if I draw parallels, for example, you have a Unilever, which is a house of brands, and it works because it is a house of brands. I may use one thing from the stable of Unilever, but I may not use another thing from the stable of Universe. And now think about it. If Unilever came and said that, oh, here's Unilever and everything is available, you can't retain me just because of that, because I may not be having the tea that you give me because I love somebody else's tea. And therefore, my use of that particular app really starts to become a problem. And I think, Samiran, the challenge that Tata Neu has is exactly that. You and I may be fans of, let's say, Vistara and Indian Hotels, but you may never be buying another Tata product. Or you may be buying, you know, you may be a person who's going into Big Basket, but not having anything to do with Tata Motors. Now, trying to put everything under this whole construct called a super app, and I honestly understood it as a house of apps more than anything else. So correct me if you guys think I got it wrong, but it seemed like that to me.
So the house of apps reminds me of like a house of cards. It just collapse, I think.
And that's my sense because it has no role to play in the consumer's life. That's it.
True.
While it's a trend to watch out for, I want to see what the world does with it. Just to be maybe proven wrong that maybe there is a role for a super app in the life of the consumer. I would love to be proven wrong on this one.
So, I mean, ultimately, you know, all of this that happens, you know, people are... It's about business, it's about eyeballs, it's about revenue growth. And, you know, for the last few years, we've been kind of going crazy with this whole thing about valuations and, you know, things doubling, tripling, quadrupling. And, you know, 10x is the new normal. You know, you can't just grow in percentage terms. Unless you're 10x, nobody will talk to you. And, you know, come 2022 and this whole thing around layoffs, suddenly we have discovered the latest mantra in survival, you know, and lo and behold, it is our age-old thing that we knew, revenue minus cost is equal to profit. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this new old mantra of business that has been rediscovered.
So Samiran gave you a sneak peek of the next trend, right? Which is the new old model of doing business. And I completely agree with him. But it has been cited as one of the trends, which is they don't really call it the way we have called it, but they call it that, you know, how fintechs are discovering new business models. We find it that these are actually the old ones. Let me take a simple example. So let's look at one of the fintechs, Klarna, right? This fintech grew to almost 40 plus billion in valuation, a crazy amount of valuation, a very pure play BNPL fintech, right? So buy now, pay later. And if you have been listening to us, we talked about it in our previous seasons. We thought it was a, you know, not a model, sustainable model, buy now, pay later. And that is what is happening to Klarna now. This company lost almost 85% of their valuation because BNPL has fallen out of favor. And Klarna is now looking at other business models. Luckily for them, I think they did raise money even at a lower valuation, but they have enough money to now pursue some other business models which have more longevity. So what are we talking about? So we are talking about the good old, you know, valuation principles whereby you don't go by, you know, number of consumers or the dream, but you actually go by pure play revenues, profits, and what is your outlook for the next 5 to 10 years, and then you do valuation. And now I think that rigor is coming back into business, and that is leading to all the companies and primarily the fintechs especially to figure out ways kind of coming in line with this new requirement of the market or of the investment funds. And one of the things that we'll see as a trend is that enterprise services will gain popularity. And again, if you have been following us in our previous seasons, we love B2B businesses, right? These are real hard businesses. You have to do the hard work and you end up making money. So enterprise fintechs, you know, as I said, this may not be the sexy part of valuation. You always want to show how many consumers you have. The B2C businesses have, you know, it's a make or break kind of stuff. If you're a great social media person, you know, you go from 0 to 10x overnight. And if not, you never rise, even if you have a great technology solution. But that is changing now. That is what we are trying to say. That is changing. Just the B2C business and just the numbers are not going to cut it anymore. And fintechs are discovering B2B payments and the enterprise models. So, yes, back to earth.
Yes, in fact, for whatever reason, you know, this thing has become an important aspect because the logic earlier was that, you know, startups are very different. They're doing disruptive things. So they're changing the way behavior of people. So obviously, you know, they're investing a lot of money and that's going to come back, pay off manifold. But somewhere people are realizing that, you know, if you're day-to-day working, I mean, the simple logic that, you know, if you are making a loss with every sale and every transaction you make, then there is no way, you know, that multiplied by as many people is only going to mean more loss. That number cannot come down. So, you know, the road to profitability, as people keep calling it, you know, that, you know, what is the road? You know, is it that there is a curve going downward that now you're slowly, slowly, you know, starting making. So I think given changing economics, given the changing thing, and I think all perspectives, you know, everybody is obviously has 2020 vision on hindsight. So, you know, now suddenly everybody thinks that profits are good. But I think the whole point is that, you know, while you invest, there has to be a timeline and horizon. You know, the biggest startups in India, I think I was just reading somewhere that out of the 100 odd unicorns, about only 23 are profitable. They are the usual ones, you know, the Zohos, the Freshworks, BillDesk, Zeroda. Companies that you know, they're doing businesses, they charge, you know, like I think Book My Show right from the very beginning had a convenience fee. You know, there was no question of you being paid to buy a movie ticket, you know, I mean, which is kind of typically seems to be the model. So I think road to profitability is actually, if that is not visible, and if revenue minus cost is always going to be negative, then, I mean, any business has to have a growth mindset, which is great, but also has to be done for making money. It cannot be. I mean, then it has to be for charity, because then, you know, you're basically just doing it for some common good and you don't care if you make money or no. So whether it's economic circumstances, the pandemic, we don't know. But I think investors, bankers, and everyone else are kind of looking at this with a much closer lens. And they're at least forcing companies to think that, you know, how can I do this, for want of a better word, profitably? I mean, can I actually make money with every transaction I do? Or is it just kind of long, dark, slippery, you know, slope?
So on an interesting note, I think if the fundamentals of business were kept in place, then the chances are that you will see more profitable unicorns. And I think that's the keyword that we're coming to, saying that, have you got the fundamentals of business right? If you've got the fundamentals of business right, then the chances are you will succeed. Currently, I think a lot of it is going on other measurement metrics. And I think the metrics is coming back to the good old days. I come from a Gujarati Baniya background, right? And cash flows and monies and percentages is something that every Gujarati businessman looks at. And I think if that lens is applied to larger businesses, the chances are we'll see more growth in business and profitable unicorns or profitable startups, if I may use that word.
No, that is why I think the neighborhood grocery store is the best, right? You know, sells for, buy something at X, sells for X plus 20%, takes home money at the end of the day, and it is a profitable business. The moment he starts saying that, oh, I am, my favorite example, Ashok Vada Pav Wala, I will build an international franchise of Vada Pavs now. He's finished. He is super profitable, and so is Muchhad. So, yeah, different paradigms, different things. But yes, I mean, I think people, I managed to wonder who are these people who do money business for profit now? Ha, ha, ha. But these are the people.
So that brings us to the end of this trend of ours. But I think the next trend that we're going to talk about is an extremely interesting trend, because it has repercussions, not just on the way we live our lives, but it also has repercussions on the impact we will have on society, on resources, on even digital resources, if I may use the word. And that's the trend of immortality. We'll come back in the next segment with the trend on immortality. So welcome back to the third trend, the trend of immortality, and immortality driven by tech. Samiran, this time I took a leaf out of your pay. I just decided to oust you on the paradox piece. And I found a fantastic paradox. And oh, I have to say it's thanks to ChatGPT, because I went to ChatGPT and asked for a paradox, which would be perfectly linked with immortality. And the paradox is called the Ship of Theseus paradox. And this paradox questions, what happens when you replace every single part of an object over time? Does it remain the same object? When you think of immortality and human beings, we are going to replace every single part of ourselves over a period of time to achieve immortality. In which case, will we become immortal humans or will we become immortal androids? That's the question we need to answer for ourselves.
Or Sheetal, will we become someone else? We are no longer.
Absolutely. We don't know if you're going to be a whole new object if we've replaced every part of our lives and every part of our body. So we may just become something that we never were to begin with. And that's going to be an interesting thing. The other challenges that I see, if immortality is digital immortality, I don't have a problem. I mean, we'll only use up a lot of server space and we will create other problems over there, right? But we can live forever on server farms. That's not the worry that I have. But can you imagine if, as on today, if we are 8 billion people on the planet and we've already stretched our resources thin, if all of us live forever? I mean, right now people are saying the max that we can live is 120 years, right? But even 120 sounds like a ridiculously long time for me. But if all of us were to live on Earth forever, what do you think are going to be the economic repercussions of it? What do you think is going to happen with Earth as a planet? I know, Samiran, you have a point of view that it'll push us into discovering outer space even more, but I just want to get your perspective on it. in terms of where in outer space do you think this is all going to happen? And there's already so much data coming in from outer space to us, which we can't deal with. What's going to happen when we all start living in outer space? That's going to be a fun trend to watch out for.
I think there's nothing like a little adversity to drive human innovation. And, you know, when we did that episode with Pramod, when we were talking about verifiable credentials, I said, you know, nothing will drive adoption of verifiable credentials like a good scandal. So I think there is nothing like, I mean, the moment it gets overcrowded, I think people will kind of find this thing. But I think more fundamental than, of course, that is like a demand supply space issue problem. But, you know, if you kind of go back and think about this, so immortality is something which has been there, I think, from mythological times. You know, everybody, you know, the gods come down and bless you with immortality. It doesn't bless you with happiness or whether, oh, you will never have to worry about food and shelter, but you will live forever, you know. So, I mean, that's somewhere ingrained in us that, you know, I want to be here for all time to come. Even the whole cycle of life that, oh, if you go, you'll come back, doesn't stop us. It's, oh, if I go, I don't want to go also. So, you know, no question of coming back. But I think what science has done is that, you know, obviously we have tried to kind of systematize this process now. And there is a ton of research going on in this whole area of immortality in real nuts and bolts terms. You know, there are companies, startups that are tinkering with cellular processes, regenerative body parts, new drugs. There is, you know, anti-aging supplements. One of the big ones, you know, and of course, it is the vanity of the rich, right? I mean, immortality, you know, the poor guy wants to, let me just survive and, you know, get going. The rich guy wants to say, I want to enjoy my wealth for life. So that's Jeff Bezos for you. And so he's got this, he's funded this startup called Altos Labs. And I think it's the co-founders are the guy, one of the guys is the Nobel Prize winning, you know, scientist for CRISPR, you know, gene editing. So they have been tinkering with this whole cellular rejuvenation programming and stuff like that. So is Alphabet, which is like Google. And Saudi Arabia has about said that in 2022, they're going to spend $1 billion on anti-aging research. And in fact, I came across this guy called Brian Johnson. He's apparently sold his startup to PayPal. And with all the money he got, we sold it for $800 million. He says that he claims that he's been able to reverse his biological age by 5 years over the last 7 months. So it's just some crazy things going around. I think we are again reaching the same point that we reach in every conversation: scientific possibility versus the ethical correctness of doing something. So, you know, I think scientific possibility is pushing it to reality now. Now, should it be done? Should it be a lottery? Like, you know, you get to live, you don't get to live. Or I think that, like everything else, will be the question we will have to grapple with soon. Because given enough time, money, brains, resources, we will probably figure out a way to, you know, live long. Because just good health is anyway taken us 15, 20 years now. You know, people are anyway living till 75. So maybe we'll push it to 100, we'll push it to 300. And, you know, then like in altered carbon or in foundation, you know, you'll kind of transfer into a new body and then into another one and whatever. I mean, scientifically, you'll probably figure it out. I kind of just worry about whether ethically it's the right thing to do or no. I think that's more important.
I completely agree with you, Samiran, on this. The whole idea about technical possibilities and the ethical dilemmas associated with that. The fact is that, you know, the resources are stretched, all said and done. And immortality is just going to add to the already existing huge problem, right? And on one hand, we are talking of immortality, and probably on the other hand, we have to figure out sustainable sources of energy, you know, renewable sources, food and everything. Because if we are planning to live for hundreds of years and the birth rate is not slowing down, so you are going to, you know, multiply very soon and very fast. And that is what brings us, this whole idea of sustainability brings us to the fourth trend, which is very close to the heart because it has a couple of elements. One is an element of decentralization. And as you all know, we are big proponents of decentralization. At Unblocks and using ArcEthic blockchain, we have created a very sustainable decentralized network. So the next trend is actually about virtual power plants, and there is an element of decentralization to it. So we'll talk about this trend, and I think this is the trend to really watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we are cursed with immortality, I think it stands to reason that, you know, we'll have to kind of make the place we live in habitable and sustainable, because, you know, at 8 billion, we are already struggling. So if this becomes 16 billion, you know, we'll probably be elbowing each other out of, you know, small spaces. So I think sustainability, just for practical reasons, for, you know, environmental reasons, for good business sense, all of that, I think it's becoming very, very important, real. It's being pushed by investment. It is being pushed by social conscience. And I think every aspect is being questioned for its sustainability factor. You know, is resources sustainable? Is, you know, your manufacturing process sustainable? Is your supply chain sustainable? And I think one of the things that we have been talking about a lot is the fact, you know, this whole crypto piece and the fact that how much power it consumes, you know, is the fact that can you have a, you know, with the classic one being that, you know, can we do carbon tracking using blockchain, which is not from a sustainable source, which itself is consuming a lot of power. So as humans kind of need more and more resources, I think power and, you know, those kind of resources become very important. And therefore, we need to kind of go back and again examine whether we can do anything with power. And I think that's where kind of Nilesh is going to kind of talk to us a little bit about what's the current thinking on this, you know. Is it virtualization? Is it decentralization? Yeah. Is it something else?
So let me kind of deep dive into this trend of virtual power plants. And, you know, I'll take the cue from Samiran, what you mentioned about how do you explain doing, you know, carbon credits on top of a blockchain, you know, recording carbon credits or ESG benefits on top of a blockchain, which consumes a lot of carbon, which is not sustainable. And how do you do that? And with immortality kind of being a trend, this is going to get worse. It's not going to improve. So the example that I find, you know, very interesting is that electric vehicles, right? When you look at electric vehicles, suddenly when you're driving an electric vehicle, you feel good about it because you are you know, concerned about the ecology and, you know, environment. But the fact is that the sources of energy are still fossil fuel, right? So how are you solving the problem? At least in India, I know the source of primary source of power is thermal and burning coal, essentially. And even if you're driving the electric vehicle, the electricity that you're getting is coming, those charges are being powered by thermal power. So that doesn't make sense. And that is where this whole trend of decentralization or virtual power plants, renewable sources comes into being. And one of the startups which I found very interesting was in UK, and they have a lot of charging infrastructure in UK. I think they're only in UK, but I really liked their background. You know, the background was that their sources are all 100% renewable. So that was one interesting thing. Now we are talking about real change. The second thing that they do, which is really, really interesting, was the fact that usually when you charge your EV, you'll take somewhere between 30 to 45 minutes, even on a fast charger, to go from 0 to 80%, let's say, right? So for those 30 to 40 minutes, you will end up having a coffee or doing something. So while that is a norm, these guys have put up, you know, bicycles, exercising bikes, and they, you know, offer those for free. You can go there and exercise, get a good 30, 40 minutes exercise and generate electricity, which actually is given as a rebate in your bill. So which I really found that interesting. So this is a change, honestly, very interesting change. And I think, Sheetal, you mentioned about a real estate, you know, a project coming up whereby, you know, whenever you're walking and all that is being used as energy to power, you know, some of the bulbs in the society and stuff like that. So now here comes this virtual power plants trend. How do you ensure that these disparate sources of energy actually feed into a single grid? So that is what is decentralization or virtual power plant mean. What we are saying is that the whole generation of electricity can be from various sources. Now, sources which are typically renewable, typical, you know, UK also has a bit of tidal energy. Now, it's not really, the tidal energy part doesn't happen on a consistent basis. It's tidal energy. Similarly, you have wind energy. So how do you ensure that you always match supply and demand? So you decentralize the sources. So generation can be from multiple sources. Then how do you bring back into a certain grid? And then how do you transmit it for the end user to consume? And the end user must be getting a mix of, they must be getting energy from mix of sources. So that is this virtual power plant trend. I think it's a fantastic, you know, it sounds very logical, but it's difficult to do. But it's a fantastic trend. And I think this is what will, you know, we were talking in our previous episode about how ChatGPT made AI accessible, right? Suddenly, even small sources of renewable power will become, you know, meaningful. Today, they are not, right? Me cycling and generating some electricity is probably going to power a bulb for 10 seconds. But it will also be meaningful because you have decentralization of sources of energy.
So, in fact, this is like, you know, think of it like an ONDC for power, right? I mean, where you have small guys. I mean, it's literally, I mean, you're doing some activity by yourself, but you have no access to the larger grid or the larger market for that matter. So, like you said, Nilesh, it's not an idea which is like path-breaking and unique. But I think it's, again, a question of that the technology to make it happen is probably coming now while the idea exists. Is that, you know, how do you take all the sources of energy, aggregate it, and then distribute it to the people who want it? It's like a network of networks, literally, that, you know, everybody will have their own thing. But unless... it's like, it's just like regular electricity. Like, unless the grid is connected, you can't transfer grid from the west of India to the east of India or from the west to the south. But what this does is that anything that you do which is extra, you can pull. I remember this project that IBM used to kind of back and still does. I think it used to be called this World Community Grid. Is that, you know, they used to install this app on your machine. And whenever your machine was idling, they used to push down some kind of a computation project, you know, and the spare capacity of your hard disk is to work on it. So it was like literally trying to build a virtual supercomputer. So I think this whole grid concepts have existed, but I think just like power, like, you know, it's difficult to store power, right? I mean, so, you know, how do you generate and distribute in real time? But absolutely, I mean, I think the idea and the technology probably need to come to that perfect reunion to make this happen.
I think it's a combination of idea, technology, and the economics, right? Because again, it cannot become a power play. I mean, I'm punning on the word power, but it cannot become a power play. It cannot be one company. It cannot be one whatever. So just the way metaverse can't be done with one company, it's almost like this cannot be done and should not ideally be done under the, you know, head of one company, because then you're going to sit with a monopolistic situation and then you're going to have problems lying there. So it's how do you get different players to agree to the terms and conditions to come and play together? I think that's going to be a big challenge, the execution of it rather than the tech behind it. And how do you get a more democratized thought process behind power supply rather than a monopolistic thought process behind, you know, power supply? So that, I think, is going to be the big challenge in this case. Having said that, I think we've covered the four trends we were talking about. And this brings us to the end of our trends episode. I know last year when we did the trends episode, we did it very, very differently from this year's trends episode. We actually talked about trends that we were going to put our monies behind, if I may use that word. And we talked about trends, and some of those trends did come true for us, right? I think most of the trends came true that we predicted last year. But I think this time we've taken a slightly different way in approaching the trends episode. It's really about what may happen or what may not happen at all and our perspective on those trends. So if you liked our banter on this entire piece of trends, please share the episode and don't forget to follow the show. We are available on all major podcast platforms. If you're on Apple Podcasts, then please do leave us a rating and a review. It helps our podcast grow. And we hope that you keep listening to us and enjoy our banter. Until the next time.